This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Cedarside. Cedarside's original 100% organic insect spray kills bed bugs, mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, mites, scorpions, roaches, and more, but is completely safe for your home, pets, and family. Go to Cedarside.com, use coupon code Hoffman at checkout for free shipping, or call 800-842-1464 and mention you heard it here. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. Layla Mudin, of course, with me today is our Hoffman Center nutritionist. She is duly credentialed as a registered dietitian, as well as having obtained a master's degree in the field of nutrition. How you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Good, good. Summer is moving along. It's just recently a really beautiful weekend.
Yeah.
It's a picture-perfect weekend with a full moon and just really delightful.
And low humidity.
Low humidity.
Yeah.
Finally, it was like really hot and impressive. And then finally, here in New York, we had one of those picture-perfect weekends. So, you know, here we are back in the office, you know, tanned, refreshed.
Yes.
Ready to go. And before we get to questions, by the way, questions can be sent to us via radio program at AOL.com, as many of you obviously know, because we're getting a lot of questions via email, radio program at AOL.com. This is a week where the Senate is considering something called the DARK Act, which is an act which is designed to muzzle the makers of non-GMO foods from declaring truthfully that the foods are not GMO. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a very peculiar situation to have the federal government and the Congress conspiring to not let Americans know what's in their food. What are they afraid of?
They're afraid that people will react to GMO and they want more GMO, unfortunately.
It's kind of like Jack Nicholson. You can't handle the truth. You remember in A Few Good Men? Yeah, that's what he said. He said, Americans can't handle the truth, so we're going to keep you in the dark because you're a bunch of ignorant boobs and you're susceptible to this superstitious nonsense that GMOs are bad.
Right.
You know, this summer we had the ultimate GMO movie. It was called Jurassic World.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a parable because, you know, they had these genetically modified dinosaurs. And they said, nothing, what could possibly go wrong here? It's perfectly safe, everything's under control, don't worry. And in movie after movie after movie, all hell breaks loose.
Yeah.
And I wrote about this recently in a blog at in our newsletter. By the way, sign up for our newsletter if you haven't already, because lots of good information there. And, you know, I got to say, I'm ashamed of our government.
I am, too. I am, too, because it's very underhanded the way they're going about it. Listen, I love the idea of GMO if we can feed the world and end food insecurity.
Yeah, that's the argument that's being made.
Yeah,
right.
I think that would be a wonderful, delightful thing. However,
Golden rice, rice that is, you know, rich with carotenoids and they can prevent eye disease in the third world where, you know, it's rampant. You know,
that would be a beautiful thing, wouldn't it? But this is very underhanded the way they're going about it. And we don't have enough research to say that harm will not ensue. So,
yeah, I mean, let's you know, summarize the arguments. You know, one is that there are unpredictable effects because we just don't really know. These are, like, people will say, look, we've been breeding plants for centuries, so true. But this is taking it to an order of magnitude where we're going beyond what is possible with ordinary animal husbandry and hybridization. And by the way, there have been some consequences of hybridization which are not so great. The flavorless tomato, you know.
Yes.
And the
flavorless chicken.
And the overinflated fruits and vegetables that look great, have fantastic shelf life, but have very little flavor and hence very little nutritional value. So already there have been some issues, but then we're going to take it to an entirely different level. And I mean, so number one. So number two, you know, also the GMO process enables farmers to spray their crops with a lot more pesticide. Pesticide residues like glyphosate have been shown to be harmful to humans.
Yes.
And so while they don't kill GMO plants, it's Roundup, basically. Roundup kills everything. And if you make a mistake and you spray a little bit of your lawn, you're going to have a hole in your lawn.
Yeah.
Well, Roundup Ready crops don't succumb to glyphosate. They're resistant, but hence it just allows the farmers to saturate their fields in glyphosate, yeah. which is not great.
That increases our toxic load.
Right. Also, yeah. there was an article actually in a very, I think, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe a little tabloidy, but mm-hmm. but very mainstream British newspaper, The Independent, mm-hmm. about one of the consequences of GMOs is that GMOs are highly resistant to disease and highly resistant to pests, and they may spread rampantly into the environment. We don't know. I mean, like the dinosaurs in Jurassic World.
They are, because there's wind, there's breeze. Yep. A lot of those seeds are going to fly over into the next farm.
And another argument is that they increase the hold of major international conglomerates on the people of the world. You know, like the independent farmer in Africa, you know, yeah. has their own traditional seed lot, mm-hmm. you know, that has been passed from generation to generation. Mm-hmm. And those seeds will be superseded by... by Monsanto, and that so the whole yes. world will be virtually under the control of a few corporations, which will concentrate an enormous amount of power and political clout and money mm-hmm. In the hands of a few oligarchs, rather than a decentralized economy where people will be more self-reliant.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, on a variety of counts, I have concerns, and I'm not sure that all GMOs are bad or toxic. I just say, look, yeah. I'm not saying ban GMOs. I'm saying let's label them so people can make a choice.
Exactly. We should be able to choose what we put into our bodies after all. So
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed.
Apropos of which, I want to share with, mm-hmm. I don't think I've mentioned this. There was an article that came across my desk, I think it was in Science News, mm-hmm. about a toe-to-toe comparison of soy oil
mm-hmm.
With coconut oil
mm-hmm.
and olive oil. And what they found is that soy oil is much more obesogenic, calorie for calorie,
yeah.
than coconut oil, which used to be stigmatized because it's saturated fat,
yeah.
and olive oil. So, and what's soy oil in? Well, virtually every salad dressing, commercial salad dressing that you buy,
yeah.
You know, fast food, potato chips, mm-hmm. You know, many chips. And, of course, it's GMO.
Yes.
And I'm not sure if that makes it necessarily worse.
Yeah.
But it
it's
is.
It's mayonnaise. It's in a lot of, it's in a whole lot of things.
Yeah.
So.
Which I, unfortunately, that's one thing I regret, because I love mayonnaise, but
yeah,
I realize I'm getting a lot of soy oil.
Mm-hmm. Well, Spectrum Naturals, can we name names?
Sure, go.
They make a soybean oil with flax, okay. a mayonnaise with flaxseed oil.
Flaxseed oil, great.
Rather than soybean oil, I like it.
Okay.
It's a hefty price tag, but I think it's worth it. The flavor is just beautiful.
I'm going to go for it.
So, yeah, why not?
Because, you know, when I make my BLT on gluten-free bread with artisanal bacon, nitrate-free, preservative-free bacon, and those heirloom tomatoes.
Do they taste like anything? Tell the truth.
Heirloom soup.
Heirloom soup?
Because they're wild and knobby looking. You know, they're really mm-hmm. wild tomatoes, and they're made from really wild seed.
Yeah.
And they have terrible shelf life.
You got to use them.
Yeah, you got to use them. You get them at the farmers markets this time of year. They're starting to show up plentifully. So I'll want to use maybe Spectrum Natural Mayo on my BLT.
There you go. Yeah. Absolutely.
They put a little slice of avocado in there, too.
Mm.
Yeah.
Nice. BLT with avocado.
Quick summer meal.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so before we start salivating here, let's answer some questions.
Okay. Our first question comes from John. Dr. Hoffman, I'm faced with a medical problem that requires I get a colonoscopy. I'm very concerned because I've heard of superbugs being embedded in the scopes after cleaning. How do I avoid MRSA or CRE or hepatitis C or any other major infection?
Okay.
What can I do here?
So we have, adding to the alphabet soup of MRSA, M-R-S-A stands for methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, which is a terrible problem because mm-hmm. it requires... ever-increasing amounts of novel antibiotics to get rid of,
yeah.
Very hard to treat, resistant, and that's due to the overuse of antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have something called CRE, which is carbenicillin-resistant enterococcus, which is a terrible gastrointestinal infection that has resulted in several fatalities. There seem to be outbreaks in hospitals where they do invasive procedures with scoping. And part of it has been implicated in a design change in the Olympus scope, where the cleaning regimen for those scopes should have been upgraded, and that should have been communicated to the hospital, because the previous regimen, you know, it's a matter of using disinfectants and high heat in an autoclave, but high heat can damage these scopes, so they have to use a special regimen to keep them clean, was not adequate to kill the bug. So the problem is partly due to our overuse of antibiotics, partly due to the scope design and the company not communicating to the hospitals the right way to clean the scope. And, you know, these scopes are reused, I mean, because they cost thousands and thousands of dollars. And, yeah, you're getting something inserted deep into your body that has been in other people, which is scary. But it's okay if the proper sterilization procedures are being used. So, you know, and the other problem is once this starts spreading in a hospital, they have to quarantine the patients because it spreads like wildfire in a hospital. I think they had a problem at UCLA in Los Angeles where several patients died and many patients were sickened. And there's just, it's virtually impossible to treat, very hard to treat.
So,
bottom line is, is, I keep doing this, that's why I'm on a roll today, supersede bottom line, is I think it's okay. I mean, I would limit unnecessary invasive procedures. You know, the routine colonoscopy that's done every, you know, 2 to 3 years on healthy people, that's passe, because now they say you go 5 to 7 years, and after a certain age, if you're okay and you don't have symptoms, you can stop getting them.
John is asking, are there any super potent supplements I could take a week before the procedure?
I would definitely
procedure?
Suggest you take probiotics, because probiotics always help. I would also suggest, here's an idea, and this is actually something that I just read, and something I've suspected for a long time, is that taking acid-blocking medication, which a high percentage of the population does, they take Nexium, they take
Prilosec,
Dexilant. These medications stop your stomach acid. And your stomach acid is actually a major defense against infection.
It's our protection.
It's our protection. And in fact, they just did a study looking at different species of animals. And they found that animals, which are scavengers, who eat offal, O-F-F, it's awful, A-W-F-U-L, but O-F-F-A-L is, you know, basically, you know, scavenged meat. Like vultures and hyenas. They have the highest stomach acid of any animals. So we tend to think of stomach acid as what's necessary to digest protein, and there is more stomach acid in carnivores than herbivores. But in order to protect against infection, high levels of stomach acid are invoked. And we kill our stomach acid sometimes for decades and years. They say, take this for the rest of your life. You go on a cruise ship, or you go to Mexico, or you go to you know, Morocco or something like that, you're going to get Montezuma's Revenge more likely than someone who doesn't take these medications. So,
And you know, a lot of people don't realize that they're only intended for temporary use, maybe a few weeks, but they're being prescribed indefinitely.
But try to get it off them. I think there's a question in our stack today about somebody who says they want to wean themselves off.
As a matter of fact,
why don't we tackle that?
Let's see here. My 65-year-old sister, this is from Suzanne. My 65-year-old sister has been taking reflux medication Nexium for years. Her new doctor would like her to get off Nexium. Hey, that's a change, right? And I've heard you talk about how difficult that can be. Dr. Hoffman, what are your guidelines for getting off Nexium? And how long does it take for the rebound reflux to stop?
That's a great question, and the answer is it depends. And so
we've had
generally, you know, so what happens is when you stop these medications, they suppress the acid, but when you withdraw the suppression, the acid rebounds and you get hyperacidity. And then it makes it seem like, oh my God, I really need to be on this medication. Perfect medication, because you get hooked on it, literally. So it in these cases, and we've done it quite a lot. Well, you know, you speak to the supplements that we use. Why don't you talk about that a little
bit? We love DGL. That helps with reflux. That's often prescribed. There's another
Which
supplement.
Which is what?
DGL, Z-glycerized licorice.
Right.
Which helps. Endofin.
And generally, we tell patients, sometimes patients say, well, it didn't work for me. I was, well, how did you use it? Well, I took one twice daily. No.
You got to
suck on these all day long, and they coat your esophagus and they coat your stomach.
Anywhere from 6 to 10 a day. Some people as much as 12 a day.
Yep.
And for those who are a little bit afraid of licorice, it's deglycerized licorice, meaning the component that might impact blood pressure is gone. It's missing. It's been deglycerized. The glycyrrhizic acid is not there. So
that's
DGL,
one.
6 to 10 or 12 a day, endofin powder, a couple of tablespoons in water twice daily in between meals can help.
And incidentally, endofin, not available in health food stores, so get it through websites like ours, drhoffman.com. It's a popular product that we give to our patients, but also we make it available to our listeners.
Yeah.
Many people are getting it off our website. Mm-hmm. They're able to obtain DGL via drhoffman.com.
Yeah. So the tapering of the Nexium, using DGL, maybe titrating up the DGL and lowering the Nexium, that's probably something that should be done under a physician's supervision, I would imagine. But both of these supplements are very, very helpful. It's very important, however, to follow a GERD diet. So you want to visit with a nutritionist who can tell you what that is. It's not just a matter of avoiding spicy foods, but acidy foods. There's acid in coffee, in tea. You want to be careful with chocolate. You want to be careful with mint, carminatives. There are many raw fruits, stone fruits, that can be problematic. Plums, peaches, the like. Strawberries may be problematic. Yes, strawberries are healthy, but for somebody with GERD, best to avoid, especially as you're tapering your medication.
Okay, so that's pretty good advice in terms of getting off of these types of medications. And actually, this kind of ties into something that I'm working on right now, which is the theme of a new book. And the theme of the book is going to be...
Do tell.
Well, I should keep it. It should be top secret, but you know, it's going to be a while. But I'm writing a proposal on a book on how to get people off common drugs.
Yes.
And there will be a chapter on how to get people off acid blockers.
Oh.
Because they're some of the most commonly prescribed medications in the United States.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. That's a very much needed book.
Yeah.
Dr. Hoffman.
All right, so hopefully, you know.
Best of luck with that. That's great.
In the works.
Yeah, Suzanne has a follow-up question about her sister. Her sister also has arthritis, and her doctor asked her to start an anti-inflammatory diet. So she's not eating grains. Did your doctor refer your sister, Suzanne, to a nutritionist because you want her to be able to get some counseling on an anti-inflammatory diet? Particularly for arthritis, what comes to mind is the nightshades.
Indeed.
The nightshade family of vegetables. That includes tomatoes, peppers of all kinds, eggplant, white potatoes, and tobacco. So even if you're not a smoker, which is great, but if you're exposed to secondhand smoke, that could be a problem. And by the way, the avoidance of peppers...
I saw this thing on TV that really got me upset. It was like this whole glowing story about cigars from Cuba. You know, it's all this, like, it's all the rage now. It's like, oh, we're reestablishing relationship with Cuba, and the Cubans are going to flood America with their wonderful cigars, and they visit this, like, you know, Juan Valdez Antonio Martinez in his in his tobacco farm in Cuba, and he rolls his own cigars. He's very proud of them, and he inherited the secret of how to make the best cigars in the world from his grandfather, and on and on and on, without any mention of the health hazards of cigars.
Terrible.
It's like, you know, it's amazing. We have basically crippled and destroyed the tobacco industry in the United States, correctly so.
Yes.
And now all of a sudden we establish diplomatic relations with Cuba, and it's going to be all the rage to smoke Cuban cigars. And they show these women, you know, puffing on these big honking cigars,
oh,
and it's all so fashionable and everything, except that it does cause lung cancer and mouth cancer, and it does cause respiratory problems to the people around.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what's the big romance? It's always Cuba. It's like Cuba. But, you know, the stinky cigars that your grandfather used to smoke, those are bad. But the new cigars from Cuba are going to be all...
That's unfortunate if that's going to be the only export, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. Too bad. And there's nothing romantic about
smoking.
And
baseball players.
And baseball players.
Right. Absolutely. We've got this guy, new guy named Cespedes, who's playing for the Mets. He's like a slugger. from, he's a Cuban defector. They play excellent baseball down there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Anyway, thank you for your question, Suzanne, and best of luck to your sister. All right. Oh, this question comes to me from Lucille. Dear Layla, my brother is 72 and has Parkinson's. Recently, on integrative holistic sites, I read that intravenous glutathione can help with Parkinson's symptoms. Does Dr. Hoffman do this at the Hoffman Center? And do you know if it's helped some patients? To be honest, you read so much on the internet these days, I wonder if it does help or if it's all hype. And if it does help, why don't you see it on the Parkinson's Foundation website?
Well, Parkinson's Foundation website is very conservative, so they will not highlight nutritional therapies generally. I wonder if they even talk about coenzyme Q10, which is marvelous for Parkinson's. But
you need boatloads of it, too.
It may come as a surprise to many of you, but Layla and I actually have day jobs. We work at the Hoffman Center and really work quite a few hours a week seeing actual patients one-on-one. That's what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, we do have an IV department. I have extensive experience in administering IVs. I'm actually teaching a course in IV administration this fall at ACAM, the American College for Advancement in Medicine. Thank you. I should know because I was president of that organization. But it's been a while. And so, you know, intravenous glutathione is one of our mainstays for treating neurological disorders, Parkinson's disease. It helps circulatory disorders. It's great for detoxification. It actually is a good antidote to chemotherapy.
Mm.
Now, maybe it shouldn't be given precisely at the time of chemotherapy because it might neutralize the effects of chemotherapy. But as an aftermath to help salvage and repair the normal cells, it could be very valuable. So... So we're big believers in intravenous glutathione. We've seen great things with chronic fatigue patients, with patients who have issues of heavy metal toxicity or other types of toxicity, mold exposure, and so on.
And for people who don't know, glutathione is
our
major detoxifying antioxidant that we make endogenously. But to get some from an IV is really a wonderful thing. I've heard you say that your eyesight gets better.
Yeah, it feels like, I wear glasses, and it feels like I've cleaned my glasses, but I haven't. And, why that is probably the photoreceptors in your eyes are very sensitive to glutathione.
Yeah.
And that, you know, your brain and your sensory organs work better. It's actually, intravenous glutathione has been recommended as a treatment for sudden onset deafness. You know, people who, you know, most people, they lose their hearing gradually, but some people get an attack of deafness. It may be due to a virus or an inflammatory disorder, and we give intravenous glutathione, and it helps to these tiny hair cells within the ear to recover better.
Wow.
So,
So, yes, Lucille, we do glutathione drips. Mm-hmm. Dr. Hoffman does, so give us a call.
Right. Or next time you go to a heavy metal concert and your ears are ringing, you've lost your hearing, come by the Hoffman Center and get a glutathione IV.
Will it help for that?
It will.
I should have known that years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. Hi, Dr.
So
Hoffman.
So actually, this is a good time at which to pause because we're going to divide this podcast into two parts, as we usually do. And in part two, give us a preview of our next question.
Oh, stage 3 melanoma.
Okay, question of nutritional support.
Yeah.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.